compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. This is our third hour of the program today. And as per usual, I have been getting a ton of emails. I want to do a little bit of responding to some of your emails in this hour. Also, I've got some stories I want to share with you. One of them is something you probably, if you're like most people, never even give any thought to, and that is the Amish folk. You ever think about the Amish folk? Well, maybe if you live in Amish country, you think about them because you see them go by with their horse carriages and things. And where we live, it's not too far from Amish country, so we don't see Amish folk right around where we live, but if we drive an hour or so, we can get to where they are. And it is interesting to consider their way of life and how detached they are from modern society. And many things about the Amish that are very puzzling to non-Amish people. And by the way, non-Amish people are called English by the Amish. They refer to us as English. I guess that would be in a way similar to how Jews typically would refer to Gentiles. Anybody who's not a Jew would be a Gentile. But the Amish people are to themselves. They're very quiet. They don't participate in the typical things that you would expect to see other people at. They don't go to grocery stores. Typically, you may from time to time find some there, but generally they make most of their own food. They have their farms and they buy and sell food for each other. They build buildings for each other. You won't see them driving cars or having cell phones. Nancy and I had some cabinets made, and we had an Amish carpenter whom we hired to do this, and everything had to be done by mail, or we had to do it in person. There was no way to call him. There was no way to email him. It was interesting for us to have to do this project that took, you know, a couple of months to complete. And we had to drive quite a ways to get to where his farm was. And on his farm is where he had his carpentry shop. And so we would deal with him directly, or we would put something in the mail. But I remember one particular day that we were there, and in his wood carpentry shop, whatever you would call it. It's a rather large place. And he had employed there maybe half a dozen young Amish guys. And we were having an interesting conversation. They were very friendly and everything was great. And I took out my phone to take a picture of them. And like, hey guys, let me get a group picture of you. And they turned around, they faced the other way. And I thought maybe they heard somebody calling them. So I waited a minute and they turned back around. And I said, let me get a picture. And they turned around again. All of them did. And they turned around all at once. And I said, what's the matter? And one of them said in a sort of a shy way, he says, we're not allowed to do that. You know, it dawned on me, of course not. I mean, why would I not know that? And so I said, you're not allowed to take pictures? And they said, well, we're not allowed to take pictures. We're not allowed to be in pictures. And I didn't press the point because I didn't want to embarrass them or anything. But long story short was that it's part of the Amish heritage to eschew modern conveniences. So they don't have refrigerators in their homes. They don't have electricity in their homes. They don't make do with, or I should say, they don't use the kind of things that we have in terms of technology and appliances and things like that. They make do with how things were before the advent of the Industrial Revolution. So it's a very interesting thing to observe their way of life. And for them, it's a religious conviction. They do this because they want to live in a way that's consistent with the Bible. And of course, in the Bible, there are no air conditioners or electrical can openers or cell phones or anything like that. So they have a theological reason for doing this. But they're sort of out of sight. And one of the things that maybe is not really well known is how big they're getting. There are a lot of Amish people now in this country. And because they, by and large, they stay far, far away from abortion, and they generally do not practice contraception, they're having children. And many Amish families have quite a few children. So this is a fascinating look at the Amish under the title, Will the Amish Take Over America? And after you're done laughing, just think about this for a minute. This is from Unheard, unherd.com. David Larson writes, most Amish communities don't allow phones in their homes, but it's not because they think phones are inherently evil and ban them completely. They have often shared phone booths at the end of the street to use when necessary and at their places of work. They just don't have phones in the home because they believe it will take away from the purpose of a home, things like family bonding and chores and recreation. And I was a firsthand witness to this, albeit very briefly, in my visits to that Amish carpenter's home. We had the occasion, there was one time when I said, "Do you have a restroom here?" And he said, "Yeah, there's one that's kind of built off to the back of the house." So they have a beautiful farmhouse, and the bathroom was basically an outhouse, and it's built onto the house. You come down this hallway, and you go in, and there's no electric light. I mean, if you had a candle with you, okay, great. If you don't have a candle with you, it's pretty dark. And it's just an open hole, and it smelled like it. And that's the family bathroom. So there's no plumbing. There's no running water. There's no none of the amenities that you would expect. And as it says here in this article, it's because they want to live a very simple life. Now, it's referring here to an article that David Larson wrote in a magazine, Crisis Magazine. And the article says, it examines the rapid growth of a community which has doubled in size in just 20 years. There are now 350,000 Amish in the United States, and their demographic growth shows no real signs of letting up. The Amish are notorious for their restrictive lifestyles, with their communities essentially functioning off the grid. Having two tween-age daughters and becoming increasingly aware of the sheer evil that is TikTok, this sounds sensible to the article's author. If only they'd change their rules about alcohol, he says, maybe I would sign up. Groups, he says, like the Amish are notable for their continued growth as a sect, even as wider America has seen a sharp drop in church attendance, particularly amongst the younger cohort. This change is almost certainly played a part in the radicalization both on the left and the right. Socially isolated Republicans, as well as self-identified liberals, are far more likely to find meaning in politics than in religion. And that's a sorry state of affairs, that's for sure. I think what he's saying is generally true, but it's unfortunate. Of the historically mainstream Christian denominations in the U.S., the majority, Catholics, Episcopalians, Lutherans and Presbyterians fought brutal wars in the 16th and 17th centuries. Western Europeans eventually grew weary of the endless sectarian violence, and the result was liberalism, the idea that the only way to stop conflict was to let people live by their own consciences. Now, this is a misunderstanding. I'm going to interpolate something here. This is a misunderstanding, and it's a facile sort of reductionism of a very complex series of factors that were involved with the conflicts that we saw in Western Europe among these different religious groups, keeping in mind that the Catholic Church is not a denomination. I think colloquially speaking, many people sort of lump it in there with denominations, but strictly speaking, a denomination in the classical sense would be within Protestantism and the different groupings within Protestantism. There is no such thing in that regard as to the Catholic Church. Doesn't mean that we don't have religious orders, we do, but it's not referring to that. It's referring in a denominational sense to different versions of the gospel, if that makes sense, and different teachings, in some cases, wildly opposite from each other, although all of these different denominations within Protestantism claim to go by the Bible alone. The other problem at this point that I want to raise is that liberalism as such was not simply a response to religion to say, hey, just let people live by their own consciences, because, in fact, that has always been the teaching of the Catholic Church. You have to obey your conscience. You have to have a properly formed conscience, but you have to obey your conscience. So it's really a straw man that we see in this article, where it suggests that the Catholics and other Christians were telling people you can't live by your conscience. So liberalism arose as a way to say, hey, just do your own thing, live by your own conscience. That's not actually true. So continuing. The biggest losers at the time were the Anabaptists, a radical sect from Switzerland whose main attribute was belief in adult baptism. The Anabaptists were widely hated and persecuted, but this wasn't totally irrational. When they did manage to take power in Germany, in the city of Münster, this is in 1534 through 1535, it ended in a bloodbath. There is a Dutch actor and tailor called John of Leiden, who made himself dictator, instigating capital punishment for lying, slander, avarice, and quarreling, as well as adultery. before changing his mind and installing free love and communism and endless terror. The Anabaptists were therefore considered a lunatic fringe, although they largely became pacifists looking for a better life. About 500 of them left southern Germany for North America in the mid-18th century, settling in Pennsylvania, the most tolerant of the English colonies established by those pro-lefties, the Quakers. Even in the 21st century, groups like the Anabaptists and the Amish have so far resisted secularization and modern fertility trends, so their numbers continue to grow at an enormous rate. Demographic projections into the distant future carry huge caveats, but perhaps one day American public discourse will care less about 1776 or 1619 and more about 1534. And he's talking there about the rise of the Anabaptists. Of course, these different groups have similar problems. One author in a book on religion and demography says that they may have strong social capital within the group, but they play little wider part in society. He points out that a similar dynamic already exists in Israel, where the ultra-Orthodox historically neither worked nor fought in the army, but as they become demographically more dominant, they have come under increasing social pressure to change. If they do adapt for the sake of the wider country, perhaps it offers a template for the future of religious America, one in which an obscure religious sect like the Amish goes mainstream, weird as it may well be. Well, it's not that weird, quite frankly. I mean, I doubt that the Amish way of life will ever become prevalent in this country. I don't think that the Amish way of life is ever going to become something that people are clamoring to know more about because of, obviously, the lack of conveniences. But they are growing. And their numbers are not only growing, but they're proliferating beyond where they typically would have been found. And I think that's a good thing in some sense. It's a good thing because it gives us an opportunity to have more encounters with them. It's an interesting thing that I discovered in my conversation with Jacob, who was this Amish carpenter who did the work for us. I had a chance to chat with him a little bit. And he makes, among other things, cabinets. That's what he specializes in. So like the kitchen cabinets that you would install. And in conversation, he mentioned to me, he says, well, you know, we don't use these things that we make. And I said, why not? He says, we just don't use them. We don't have cabinets. We have like, they would have hutches. They would have, you know, drawers, a chest of drawers kind of thing. They would have shelves. He sort of described it. I didn't go into his house to see what any of those things looked like other than going to the restroom, as I described to you a minute ago. But he says, even though they make these things for other people, they don't make use of them themselves. So it was interesting to me. And had there been more time, I think it probably would have gotten around to the point of talking about religion a little bit, talking about the faith. But the main thing I took away from them is that they don't evangelize. They're not out proselytizing. They don't send Amish missionaries to different areas to try to convert people to the Amish way of life and to their religion. They're very much to themselves, but they're growing not because of conversions. They're growing because of having children. So they are heeding that call, that exhortation to be fruitful and multiply. And in time, we'll see. You know, what does that mean for the population of the Amish compared to those populations that are dwindling because they are not having children? Fascinating. And Cyrus, you'll get a link to that posted. Have you ever met any Amish people? Have you ever been around them or talked to them before?
I've seen them with their horse-drawn carriage going mm-hmm. down the street, but I've never engaged. They seem very nice.
Yeah, they're nice. I mean, they are standoffish. They don't intermix with people, but once you do talk to them, they're friendly, at least the ones that I've had an occasion to talk to. They're not in any way antagonistic or I was pleasantly surprised. And I've also had the occasion to talk to some Mennonites too, because the Mennonites, maybe one way to describe it is they follow somebody who came out of that world, and it was a more reformed sort of version of the life that the Amish live, but they have very much in common, and their roots trace back to the Anabaptists. And they too, very friendly. They dress in a more kind of outdated conservative way. You can tell them when you see them, but they will drive cars and they will go to grocery stores and do all the the standard things that anyone else would do. They're sort of a more relaxed version, my understanding is, of the Amish. But if ever you get a chance to chat with them, I think you'll find it very interesting, very eye-opening.
Yeah, that's cool. Honestly, everything I know about the Amish, I learned from a movie called The Witness, an old Harrison Ford movie.
I remember it.
And that's all I know.
Now, passing on from the Amish to something else that we've heard a lot about in recent decades, and that is the so-called traditional masculinity, also sometimes referred to as toxic masculinity. The New York Daily News has an article on traditional masculinity is officially labeled harmful by the American Psychological Association. The new, quote, guidelines for the psychological practice with boys and men marks the first ever report published by the association aimed at helping practitioners care for their male patients despite social forces that can harm mental health. Citing more than 40 years of research, the APA warns against the masculinity ideology. Now, this is a quote from this report. They're warning against the masculinity ideology, which they define as, quote, a particular constellation of standards that have held sway over large segments of the population, including anti-femininity, achievement, eschewal of the appearance of weakness, and adventure, risk, and violence. Let's pause there for a second. Anti-femininity, depending on what that's supposed to mean, would be wrong because men are made for women and vice versa. And we complement each other and we need each other. So men should be valuing and recognizing and being grateful for the contributions that women bring to society. And so should women be grateful for those things that men bring. The problem here is if by anti-femininity, what they mean is the culture in, well, the way in which men generally, in most cultures, see being effeminate or being a sissy as something wrong. It's not masculine. That's true. And that's not anti-women. That's not looking down at women. That's recognizing that in men, you have certain characteristics that are masculine that are real and they are proper to men. Now, we're not talking about being mean to women. We're not talking about anything derogatory or misogynistic or anything like that. So if that's what was in their minds when they wrote this, then, of course, that's a separate issue. But I'm just talking about men, whether people like it or not, men, generally speaking, look down upon men who are effeminate. And that's just how it is. It's just the way men are. A limp handshake is not going to get you very far in a man's world because a limp handshake suggests kind of weakness of character. And weakness, I mean, we're all weak, each in our own way. And the strongest, most robust man has his own weaknesses. We all have weaknesses. But we're talking here about how men sort of take the measure of other men in terms of, you know, firm handshake. Will this guy look you in the eye? That kind of thing. There's certain markers, there's certain behaviors that suggest to other men that you are a good guy or that you're trustworthy. So they talk about anti-femininity. But my gosh, achievement, eschewal of the appearance of weakness, and adventure, risk, and violence, these are all inherent aspects of masculinity. You can't deprogram. Well, you can maybe psychologically, you can brainwash some men, I guess, to look at this as something wrong, but it doesn't change the fact that men are, generally speaking, the ones who are adventurous when it comes to physically dangerous things, contact sports, taking risks, fighting against enemies, the way in which men, generally speaking, historically speaking, have subdued nature and have conquered other nations and things like that. This is all part of masculinity. Now, again, please, I'm not suggesting that any of the negative ways in which these things can be exhibited, that those things are good. I'm not saying that. I mean, it's not a good thing. It's something that should be deplored. So in no way are we defending the negative things. But just the aspects of adventure and risk and even violence and achievement and looking at the appearance of weakness as something that men typically don't do, that's all normal. And I'm surprised, or maybe I'm not surprised, that the American Psychological Association hasn't figured that out by now. Traditional masculinity, they say, And traditional masculinity ideology has been shown to limit males' psychological development, constrain their behavior, result in gender role strain and gender role conflict, and negatively influence mental health and physical health. And that was a quote from the 36-page report. Conforming to the norms of the masculinity ideology can result in suppressing emotions and masking distress in young boys, as well as more risk-taking and aggressive behavior and a lack of willingness to seek out help. The report additionally contends that this can lead to traits like, quote-unquote, homophobia, and pave the way for sexual harassment, bullying, and violence against others and themselves. Okay. Here's where this is a mishmash of what's true and not true, if you ask me. Maybe true in a certain clinical sense, but not true in others. So when we return from this quick timeout, what I want to do is sort of take a quick view of these things and offer you what I see is where they missed the mark on this issue, and offer maybe from some real-world examples how this can really be understood maybe in terms of a both-and as opposed to an either-or. So we'll take a quick timeout. We'll come right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
We've been spending most our lives living in an Amish paradise. I churn butter once or twice, living in an Amish paradise. It's hard work and sacrifice, living in an Amish...
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, welcome back. Welcome back, welcome back.
Okay, we're back, and we're spending a little time today talking about what the American Psychological Association has deemed to be toxic masculinity. And my concern is more that they have maybe lumped actual toxic masculinity, which is a bad thing, you know, where it involves aggression or bullying or just dominating people. That, of course, is not good. And we don't, I certainly don't endorse that. I certainly don't try to defend it. But toxic masculinity is not the same thing as traditional masculinity.
So are you going to mansplain it to us?
Well, I guess I am, as a matter of fact, because I am a man. And if a man explains,
a man.
Who talked like that? Was that Jethro?
I don't know.
Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah. Maybe.
He's a man. I can't even do the accent right. But yeah, I am going to mansplain it to you because I'm a man. What can I say? And that's the other thing that's kind of ludicrous is that if a man explains anything, suddenly he's now quote unquote mansplaining. What does that even mean? Is that like men are not allowed to explain something?
Yeah, it's like man spreading. You know, you sit down on a bus with you're sharing with other people, and
right.
you spread your legs as far as you possibly can, taking up as much room. So you got man spreading, you got mansplaining.
Well, you know, there's a reason for that, and I mean, this is a family show, so we don't have to go very far. But you don't need to go very far to explain it. Women, by virtue of their apparel,
moving on.
Think about it. Women, by virtue of their apparel, have a reason for maybe sitting more compactly. And men who don't have that issue, I mean, unless you're in Scotland and wearing a kilt or something, which is a different story, you don't have that constraint. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong whatsoever. Also, nothing wrong with a man explaining something.
Well, you know, one time. Thank you for mansplaining that.
Yeah, I'm here for you. I'm happy to do it. True story, Cyrus. I was on Twitter. I said something or other on Twitter, or somebody said something to me, and I responded to it. Well, the wife of Jim Gaffigan, her name is Jeannie Gaffigan. You know, the comic, the comedian.
Mm-hmm.
She sent me a note. Or her response to me was, "Thank you for mansplaining it." And I don't know her. I mean, I know of her, of course, but I don't know her. So she somehow ran across whatever it was I had said, and she said, "Thank you for mansplaining it." And I responded to her saying, "I'm here to help," or something like that. "I'm happy to help," or something like that. So she at least she liked that. So there was no acrimony or anything. But anyway, So the APA, they've invoked a series of sobering statistics to emphasize that what they're saying here is a quote, traditional masculinity marked by stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression is on the whole harmful. For example, despite being four times more likely to die of suicide than women, men are significantly less likely to be diagnosed with internalizing disorders because, quote, they don't conform to traditional stereotypes about men's emotionality. Men in the United States, they say, also commit an estimated 90% more homicides than women and are also much more likely to be arrested for domestic violence. Despite its warnings, the APA also encouraged men to embrace positive aspects of traditional masculinity like leadership and courage. Though men benefit from patriarchy, they also are impinged upon by patriarchy, says Ronald Levant, a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Akron. He's also the co-editor of the APA volume, The Psychology of Men and Masculinities. Guidelines for the Psychological Practice with Boys and Men additionally calls on those treating male patients to recognize their own bias and urges them to address how power, privilege, and sexism work, both by conferring benefits to men and by trapping men in their own narrow roles. Again, I can see a point that they're making here, Cyrus. They're not entirely wrong. And I know they're probably laughing, saying, who is this guy? He doesn't have a degree in psychology. He doesn't have any training in psychology, and he's opining that we are partly right. I could just imagine the laughter. But hear me out. You don't have to have a degree in psychology to understand that there are certain aspects of femininity and certain aspects of masculinity that are built in. It's just part of the nature of things. Now, they mention in this last bit I just read to you, they mention things like, okay, stoicism, not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, in some things, it's exactly what you want. If you're at war and your army populated primarily by men, or if you want to go back in time and look, let's say, at, you know, the Battle of the Bulge in World War II or some of the other protracted campaigns and battles, often, or at least sometimes anyway, during the dead of winter, these men had to be stoics. And to be stoical means that you sort of are impervious to the difficulties and suffering that you experience in a bodily way. So whether it's cold or heat or hunger, I mean, we want Navy SEALs to be stoics. To be stoic in this sense is to draw upon your ability to ignore the pain that your body is feeling because of the elements and learn how to push through it. And if you don't have people who can do that, we're going to lose every war we ever fight. So there is a positive side of all this. And I think each one of these things has a positive side to it. Now, there can be negative sides, and we certainly see that, in which men, because of their dominance, you know, physically speaking, for example, bigger, taller, that kind of thing, heavier, that men can make use of these attributes in ways that are wrong, that are immoral. And I want to emphasize that in no way are we even remotely suggesting that there's anything good or acceptable about those things. Those are always to be condemned. But we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because if you lose sight of the fact that men are inherently a certain way, you'll never understand reality. And the same would be true for women. Women are generally speaking, a certain way. They have certain attributes, certain ways of being feminine. And that's how women are. And I thank God for it. Because if women weren't that way, if women, imagine, Cyrus, if all the women in the world acted like men in terms of, let's say, the masculine attributes of, you know, ambition. And what were some of the other things that they listed here just a second ago? So we're looking
at thinking of all the things we'd lose.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Stoicism, competitiveness, dominance. It'd be miserable. You know, all of the feminine attributes of the way in which they civilize men, you know, and the way in which they bring beauty and order so often. It would be a terrible world to live in if men and women all acted the same way, whether all like women or all like men, if you ask me. So looking at this, you want stoicism. You want the Navy SEALs to be stoical. You want them to be able to learn how to rise above the difficulties of weather, being cold. You know, Cyrus, when the Navy SEALs are going through their training, I've talked to a couple guys over the years who have told me this. They've said, yeah, you're wet and cold all the time, and you're always way short on sleep. So you're running and doing all kinds of incredibly difficult physical exercises, often soaking wet and in the wind, and you're shivering, and you haven't slept in 24 hours, and they just push you and push you and push you. And, you know, that I don't think I could ever do that. I mean, I know I couldn't do it now, but I don't think I could have done it when I was 25.
No, and that makes sense. Remember your training is a common saying, and that's how you'll remember it, is if you go through it over and over and over again. So when you actually need to remember your training, you'll be able to do it automatically without thinking about it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a very good way to put it. Is that from the Navy SEALs? I mean, I guess that's probably something that they
say. When I was a firefighter, that was something we'd say. Remember your training.
Right.
Like, stuck with me.
Yeah. So you know what to do. And that way you don't get caught by surprise. I have one friend who didn't make it to the end of BUDS, which is what they call the process, or, they weed out the guys who don't make it, and the guys who do make it, they go on to become Navy SEALs. And he did, I think he said he did 6 weeks of the training before he realized that this wasn't for him. But, you know, he was very physically fit and very athletic, so it wasn't as though he didn't have the physical capabilities. But I think in his case, he realized that he wanted to go in a different direction, and he wound up doing that. But he shared with me some of the things they went through. And, you know, he talked about how one particular time, this whole squad of guys, and it might have been, I don't know, maybe 10, 20 guys, and they had to spend the night on the rocks of a jetty. This is in Southern California. You know, the jetties that stick out, you know, to either break the waves, or they're there for like channels for fishing boats to come in and out. So it's just a bunch of boulders that come up out of the ocean, and then on the top of that.
Can't sleep on those?
Well, they didn't do much sleeping.
Yeah, I bet not.
But he said that their orders were that they had to stay like, waist deep in the water, or they had to have maybe their feet in the water, and they were in gym shorts, and that's it. And it was nighttime, and it was cold, and it was like, 50 degrees out that night. And they had to stay the whole night on these rocks, and that was it. There was no food. There was no warmth. There was nothing. And
that is not on the brochure.
Yeah, they probably won't get too many takers. But I'm guessing the guys probably know going into it, especially now that they're on YouTube videos and so many things that talk about that. But here's the thing that he said that really stuck with me. He said that the Navy SEAL training program, and this ties in with the whole idea of masculinity and stoicism and aggression when necessary. At times, you do need to be aggressive. You do need to be aggressive against somebody who's coming through the window of your home at 3 a.m. to harm you and your children. That's the time to be aggressive. There is a role for competitiveness. There is a role for dominance. There is a role for stoicism. These are not harmful in themselves. They can be made harmful, obviously, but men tend to be this way. And we should thank God that he made us male and female so that when it's necessary for stoicism and competitiveness and dominance and aggression, that we have people who will do that. So the way my friend put it to me was, he says, it's training for your soul. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, the way he looked at it was, he realized you're always cold when you're doing the Navy SEALs training. And for the Navy SEALs out there listening to this, they're probably saying, man, you don't even know the half of it. It's even worse than you imagine. And I believe them. But what he said was, in that 6 weeks of training, when you're always sore, your muscles are always overtaxed, you're always tired, you're always wet, and you're always cold, and there's no let up, there's no relief, there's no day off, you're just going at it constantly. He said he thought of it as, it's training my soul to not give in to whatever the bodily demands might be. And I mean, he told me this probably 10, 12 years ago, and it's always stuck with me, because it's a really good insight. So whether you're male or female, These are all aspects that have a good side to them. There can also be a bad side to them. Well, anyway, there's that. Any Navy SEAL training stories you want to tell? Anything that you...
I don't. All this talk of masculinity, I wonder, you know, about the word feminist. So if you're so promoting masculinity, does that make you an anti-feminist?
Well, I have a thought on that. How would you define feminist? What's your definition of that term?
Well, I'm sure there's all kinds of definitions, but the one here is, let's see. At its core, feminism is the belief in full social, economic, and political equality for women.
Yeah, I believe in that.
Yeah, me too. So we're feminists.
Well, not so fast. Because I think the word feminist carries all sorts of connotations. One of them being, you know, anything a man can do, a woman can do better. I've heard people say that, and that's not true. It's true of individual women, perhaps, or individual men, perhaps. But look at all the stories that we've done on the program over the past years of female athletes who are at the peak of their physical condition. They're extremely competitive against their female peers. They are trained so highly, and they can win all of the meets, all of the championships, etc., until the man shows up who is biologically male, but who now identifies as a woman. And so he's now legally able to compete with the women, the actual women, in women's sports. And we've seen so many times where the male, who is really very often, we did one particular article where it went through a whole bunch of different guys who had won at women's sports, who had won championships in first place and things
like
that.
After years of mediocrity.
Mediocrity. And maybe not even charting. In the case of, you know, getting to the top 100 or something, and suddenly now they're winning these women's events.
Yeah,
so, and the reason is because they're not women, they're men.
Right, competing against fellow men, they're no good. Yeah. Or not, well, they're not good enough to be...
they're not champions.
They're not champions, yeah. Or successful. And then they transition, and they're crushing the actual females that are playing the sport.
Right.
Where are the feminists... Then, where are the vocal feminist groups?
Crickets at that
they're
point.
But that's how loud that particular group is, that the real feminists are scared to say anything.
Yeah.
Because they'll get crushed.
And, you know, J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, she had the temerity to stand up and speak out on this issue. And she said that, well, if transgenderism continues this way, then the whole idea of women's rights doesn't have any meaning, because you know, you can't even define what a woman is at that point.
And I bet she would, if she wasn't a multi-billionaire, I bet we would have heard the last of her. But she's so rich, you can't keep her quiet.
That's right. Although I think she did sort of back down. She didn't say much about that afterward. But you're right. I think she was insulated from much by way of punishment. I mean, they can't take her job away from her. They can't deplatform her. She has far too much money. But suffice to say, I know we have to take a break here in a second. Suffice to say that there is genuine good in these masculine attributes, especially when they're put to the service of protection and serving the country and all the things that go with that. And I'm not speaking just in a military sense, you know, protecting your family, protecting your children. These are all important. And the same is true, to go back to your question about feminism. I'm not a feminist if that's the title that's being offered, because feminism, it has connotations that I don't agree with. But I certainly concur with and I support many of those goals, especially the ones that you just read when it comes to women and women's rights. I certainly do favor that and uphold that. But just as there can be a toxic masculinity, there can be a toxic femininity, and that would be an imbalance as well. So I would rather that we just look at each other as male and female, as God created us, and let's bring out the good in each other. And those actual attributes that are unique to women or unique to men, let's cultivate those and let's make them good and channeled for good purposes, as opposed to saying that, well, just because you're a man and you have masculine tendencies, therefore it's bad all the way around, because it's not bad all the way around. Same is true for women. Anyway, that's my take on it, Cyrus. I think we're due for a break. So why don't we do that now? We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, welcome back. Well, I promised at the beginning of the hour that because we're sitting on a stack of emails, probably taller than I am, I need to do some more emails. We'll do some of that now. This first one, it comes in from Rick. He says, am I sinning if my wife and I practice NFP but don't have a valid reason not to have more children? So he gives some backgrounds. He and his wife are just about a little over 40 years old. They have several boys between the ages of 11 and 3, 3 to be exact. They're all Catholic, and their kids are in Catholic school. His wife had a couple of miscarriages, and his wife accepts the use of NFP, so that's what they do. Now, let me pause and identify or define NFP for those who may not be familiar with it. NFP stands for Natural Family Planning, and this is a means by which a married couple can avoid pregnancy by having recourse to the woman's natural cycle, her monthly natural cycle. And during that cycle, and of course, all you women, you know what I'm talking about. Some of you men may know what I'm talking about. A lot of men don't know what I'm talking about. But during the course of that monthly cycle, there is a period in there called ovulation. And that is the peak time for fertility. And what occurs during ovulation is that is when the ovum, the egg, is at the place where if it's going to be fertilized, that's the most likely time it's going to be fertilized. Now, once you get outside of the fertile time, then the possibility of conception goes way down to the point of nothing. And so there's a window before and after. And if you consider like a 30-day calendar month, every woman's cycle is going to be different, so the ovulation period is going to be different for every woman. But generally speaking, it's going to be maybe 4 or 5 days, roughly. And if you want to build in kind of, you know, a day on the other side or 2 days on one side or the other, that's often how it's done. So NFP is this natural process by which the married couple, and primarily it would be the woman, but the husband can help, by observing the natural signs that are corresponding to her cycle, the woman, the couple, can determine with a very high degree of accuracy when is that time of ovulation. And once you know when that time of ovulation occurs, then you can plan around it. So NFP is the couple's free decision to avoid marital intimacy during the time of ovulation so as to avoid conception. Now, it's not contraception. Contraception is where you enjoy the benefit, you enjoy the pleasure of the marital act, but you do something to frustrate the possibility or to foreclose on the possibility that there could be any transmission of life, any procreation. So that could be done through a barrier, it could be done through a chemical, it could be done through an operation. There are a variety of ways it can be done. And that, of course, would be seriously sinful. NFP is not that. NFP is like fasting. NFP is where, you know, you're hungry and you sure would like to have some food right now, but instead of having the food, you fast from it. It involves a little bit of suffering. But in the end, you maybe avoid gaining weight, or maybe you lose weight, or there's some benefit to you by fasting. And you can think of NFP in that regard. So that's the background of his question. So he's saying, are we sinning because we don't have a valid reason to practice NFP? He says, referring to me, you mentioned previously that there needs to be a valid reason to use NFP, not just any reason. You cited primarily health, spacing out of children, and income. He says, I have a well-paying job, so finances are not an issue. Our children are spaced out. And I know what he means by that. He doesn't mean that they're spaced out. Their ages are spaced out. We are both in good health, he says. I'm not sure if my wife's miscarriages would be considered a valid reason not to have any more children. I'd appreciate any guidance you have regarding this. Thank you and God bless you. And Relevant Radio. Well, thank you, Rick. So let me give you the simple answer. The simple answer, I believe, is no, you're not committing a sin if you and your wife have reached the point where you feel that you have about as much as you can handle. Now, if your finances are not an issue, if that's not an issue, that's a good thing. If health is not an issue, that's a good thing. Do you have to have an urgent reason? No. Especially for younger couples. Now, you're in your early 40s. So one thing to keep in mind is that it seems that women who get pregnant in their 40s have a higher chance of having maybe pregnancy complications or issues. But even those would be in the minority. It's not like a guarantee that that's going to happen. But for some women, it does happen. And for them, they take that into consideration and say, just given everything else, we are going to use NFP as a way to avoid conception so that we don't have a situation like that. There's nothing wrong with that. And the church says that God gives you and your wife the role of prudently determining what is best for you. So the church's point here with regard to NFP is that it's a good and useful tool that God himself has designed into women's physiology. And you're not doing a bad thing by engaging in it. It could become, I would say, bad or even sinful if the couple is saying, we never want to have children, ever. And we don't have any reason for that. You know, we just like our life, just the two of us. And the problem there would be if the couple lives their married life enjoying the pleasure and the good of marital intimacy, and yet does so in a way that sees to it, more or less effectively, that there will never be any children, I would say that is a distortion of the whole purpose of marriage. So to go continuously without any good reason, I'd say, yeah, that would be wrong. And I don't get the impression that that's what's going on in your case. You already have children. There have been some miscarriages, so there's a concern about that, obviously. Given the age now, that's another factor. But rather than kind of be reductionist and say, what's the least amount that we have to do to not be committing a sin? Or what's the most that we can do without committing a sin? I would suggest to you that you and your wife, after prayer, just consider the fact that maybe God does want to bless you with more children. And because you don't have any compelling reasons not to accept a blessing of a child into your life, why not just be willing to accept it and see what happens? Now, it may not happen. That may not be part of God's plan for your family, but it may well be. And wouldn't it be a sad thing if you looked back later, or imagine if you look back later, let me put it this way, after another son or daughter is born to you, and you look back when that son or daughter is 5, 6, 8, 10 years old, and you say, what if we had just continued using NFP and God never had a chance to bless us with this child? And how different our life would be if this child wasn't in our family. So if you consider it from that perspective, I don't think you have anything to lose if you say, you know what, we're just going to go on, we're going to go off NFP, and if this is God's will for our family, so be it. You really have nothing to lose, because if he wants to bless you with a child, what a blessing. And to be able to look back later and say, I'm so glad we were open to life, you'll never regret that. On the other hand, if it's not God's intention to bless you with another child, then you don't have anything to worry about. It'll work out in the end either way, if you ask me. So that would be my advice. You know, maybe this is the time that God is calling you to say, okay, no more NFP, and we're just going to see what God's will is for our marriage, which would be a beautiful thing. Well, you know, I was hoping to get to more emails than just that one, but that one was so good and on such an important topic, it was worth our time to spend a little extra time going deeper into that topic of NFP. Well, we're out of time for the show today, so I'll have to leave it at that, but I'm looking forward to being with you again soon. And until then, if you want to send me an email, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can send me an email there. You can also find me on Twitter at @PatrickMadrid. And between now and the next time we're together, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.